This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, David Frum, was the presidential speechwriter who originated the phrase, the axis of evil, which President Bush used 1 year ago in his State of the Union address to describe Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. Actually, Frum's phrase was the axis of hatred. It was changed to axis of evil in the editing process. We'll get to that a little later. Frum was a special assistant for economic speechwriting during President Bush's first year in the White House. Frum's new book is an account of that year. It's called The Right Man, The Surprise Presidency of George W. Bush. Frum is a political commentator on NPR's Morning Edition, a contributing editor to the National Review, and a fellow at the conservative think tank the American Enterprise Institute. One of his previous books, Dead Right, was about the American conservative movement. Yesterday, we recorded an interview about his new book. I want you to describe the atmosphere in the Bush White House. From your book, it sounds like it was pretty formal.
Yes. The Bush White House was I discovered this accidentally, the last place in America where a man can feel underdressed coming to work in a brown suit. It had a nice feeling, though. You know, the kind of high-tension confrontations you see on the TV show, the West Wing, with people jabbing fingers into each other's lapels, there was none of that. There was a code of gentleness of manner that was very sweet and endearing. And I think that is a large part of sort of the mystery of the Bush administration, is that the people there came to feel great loyalty toward each other because, by and large, they treated each other very decently.
Now, you said that there's like no cursing in the White House, and that when you once said, damn sure, the temperature in the room dropped several degrees. On the other hand, one of the big famous Bush administration gaffes is when the president didn't realize he was in front of a live microphone, and he said, that's Adam Clymer, Major League a-hole from the New York Times, and Dick Cheney answered, yeah, big time. So how do you reconcile that?
The president is the president. He's got his own rules. I wouldn't want to say there was no cursing in the Bush White House. I wasn't in every room and in every meeting. But what I did notice was there was a kind of soft manner that is absorbed from the culture of modern evangelicals and that really set the tone. And as you say, I mean, I had this is where I let slip a pretty mild curse by my standards and realized I'd done something wrong. The tone of that administration is not all set by the president. It's a bureaucracy, and the bureaucracy in many ways sets its own standards, which are sometimes a little different from the behavior of the people at the very top.
Now you said that the Bush White House had a rule, no marijuana after college. Explain that rule.
When you go to work at the White House, you have to go through a whole series of security clearances. And once a clearance is put in place in 1947 or 1972, it never comes off. So there's this ever higher tower of regulations that are ever more insane. One of them, for example, is that you are supposed to list every foreign trip you've ever taken, the date of departure, the date of return, all the places you visited in between, for the past 15 years. This rule was put in place back when people visited Europe on the SS United States maybe twice in a lifetime and is still there in the day of the $299 weekend fare to Paris, but it's enforced. One of the other rules they have is they look through your background. Obviously, it is illegal to smoke marijuana, and that is something that goes into your record. Now, different administrations have enforced the rule against having smoked marijuana in the past with greater or less severity. The Bush administration enforced it very severely. There was an exception. They overlook marijuana smoking in college, but if you continued afterward, you were disqualified from a position of trust under the United States.
And do they just ask you or do they investigate this?
Well, they ask you and they investigate, but it would be a very serious crime to lie.
So what was your answer, if you don't mind telling us?
My answer was I smoked marijuana in college and not afterward.
Okay. You say one seldom heard an unexpected thought in the Bush White House or met someone who possessed unusual knowledge. Conspicuous intelligence seemed actively unwelcome in the Bush White House. What do you mean and why do you think that was so?
Well, one element of George Bush's background is very, very unusual, I think unique for modern president, which is he's the only president who has had the experience of having been a White House staffer himself. He wasn't on the payroll, but he functioned in his father's vice presidency and then in his father's presidency as a mid-level staffer. And he got to witness how the White House staff goes wrong. The White House has often tried to employ very brilliant people, and there are There are many of them in the Clinton administration. There were a couple in the elder George Bush administration. There were some in the Reagan administration. Some of these people had a habit of being quite destructive. One of the most famous of them is a man named Richard Darman, who was the budget director under the elder Bush. I mean, just, people don't get smarter than Richard Darman, but he was a completely destructive presence in the force of the White House. And so President Bush, when he was drawing up his staff, the president has access to all the talent he wants. He can have anybody. He decided that what he was looking for was less brilliance and more steadiness, trustworthiness, and loyalty to himself. Now, that had the advantage of this nice tone that we were talking about before, and certainly has the advantage that the people there are very loyal to the president, as they should be. But it has a cost, which is that the president, I think, loses the benefit of hearing from very unusually minded people. You need one or two of those folks. And there tended not to be many of them in the Bush White House. There are some exceptions. Let's not make a mistake. The average level of intelligence was very high. And there were people of phenomenal mind, like Karl Rove, who in a weird way combines the role both of being like the political boss of the Bush White House and also it's Arthur Schlesinger Jr., it's court intellectual, the guy who's read more and knows more than anybody. He is a startling exception to that rule. But the rule is the rule.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Frum. He's a political journalist and commentator, former speechwriter for President Bush. His new book is called The Right Man, The Surprise Presidency of George W. Bush. Let's talk a little bit about writing speeches. Your focus was economics, at least until September 11th. Yeah. Let's start with your economic speeches. Do you have a favorite phrase that you came up with for one of your speeches?
Well, I had a favorite experience. About a week after I started at the White House, I was given an assignment of writing a speech for the president to alert the country to the news that a serious recession was on its way. It wasn't clear yet whether it had started. This was early February. It wasn't clear yet whether it had started, but everyone understood it was on its way. It had been coming for some time. And the president wanted some language to describe this. I just couldn't think of anything, and I was new to it, and I found it very frustrating, and you're too self-conscious when you write. I mean, the power of the presidency and all of that, and what's going to be given in the Rose Garden. I ended up wasting the whole afternoon trying one thing after another. Went home, then I thought I'd come in early. I'd forgotten I had carpool duty. I had to drive my kids and some neighbor's kids to school, and as I pull out of the driveway, the indicator light goes on in my minivan. My wife did not refuel it. She had it the other day. She hadn't refueled it before. She parked it. Oh, brother. I had to end up driving all the way to the school and then all the way back to town with this indicator light flashing at me. Bingo. So I wrote the speech in which I said, there's a warning light flashing on the dashboard of our economy. And the president said in the Rose Garden, and it was the quote of the week in Newsweek, and it led the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and it was on the Reuters wire. This is pretty exciting.
You talk a little bit in your book about the editing process of speeches, and yes. You say Karen Hughes, who used to be communications director in the White House, forced every Bush speech through a drastic translation process. What's an example of what the process was like?
Well, Karen was a very powerful person, unafraid of anybody, and she had a series of rules about the way you had to talk to the American people. For example, you were never to use the word parents. You were to say moms and dads. You were never to use the word businesses. You were to say employers. Above all things, she hated the word but, because that drew contrasts and implied you had to have one thing or the other. Better to use and, better still to use the conjunction as. And as we go forward, so we make progress, that kind of thing. I have to say, as I repeat all this, you can see this can be mocked. But in fact, it is the way people talk, and it does have an impact. And she gave Bush tremendous service. Bush was himself a very active editor, which may surprise some people who don't believe that he cared much about words, but he cared, and even if words sometimes eluded him, that made him care about them all the more. He was very alive to what he wanted to say, and he was a very precise editor. He would read drafts himself, usually pretty early in the morning, and he would read them with this big marking pen in hand, and we all got to know his fierce scratches and notes that if he saw something he didn't like, you would see it. You get the annotated version back, or he would telephone you, or summon you into the Oval Office, which was the worst of all. I once wrote the phrase in a draft speech: "I have seen with my own eyes," and Bush circled the words "with my own eyes" and wrote beside it in big letters, "Duh." He has a very, very precise mind, and if he saw stray thoughts, things not in the place where they naturally ought to go, he would corral them with this inky lariat and pull them back into place.
President Bush has been mocked a lot for misusing words, for coining words that don't exist, and, you know, for Bushisms. Having written for him, what do you think of his ability to just speak extemporaneously?
I was struck the first time I met him by this shock of this commanding figure. I was not prepared for this. I had seen all of those parodies, too. I'd seen the Bushisms, too. And I was expecting somebody who was maybe a little more unsure. But from the moment you see him, he's completely in command. And he does speak more fluently in private than in those days he did in public. Maybe he had stage fright. I don't know. But here's a strange thing that I always did notice with his private speech. At the same time as he made all these malapropisms, he also used a kind of almost old-fashioned linguistic correctness. President Bush is, I think, the only person of his generation I've ever heard use constructions like "I should have done so" and "hitherto," "henceforward."
"Hitherto" is almost archaic. I mean, that's not just tidy. That's
it's literary.
Well, it's a very written, not spoken type of word.
But his speech has those patterns in it that are, at the same time as he can then verge on ultra colloquial Texanisms, that he's got these memories of Victorian English all embedded in his speech.
It almost sounds like he was trying too hard to,
that was completely natural. I mean, that was the thing you do not see him do. You never see him reaching for the $5 word. He speaks the way he speaks, he does the things he does, and you can like it or not.
If you're just joining us, my guest is political journalist and commentator David Frum. His new book, The Right Man, is about his experiences writing speeches for President George W. Bush. Describe what it was like in the White House on September 11th when you found out what was happening and you were told to evacuate.
It was just a terrible day. Traffic was snarled in Washington all morning as if there was some premonition that something terrible was about to happen in the world. Maybe somehow it had already begun. I didn't get to work until almost 9, which was very, very late, and pulled into the parking spaces at the executive office building and walked in a little before 9. My cell phone went. It was my wife. She told me that something terrible had happened in New York and to turn on the television set. I got inside, saw the news, and then all these rumors began to fly that there were bombs on the Mall, that there had been a bombing at the State Department, and I realized that this is going to be a day like no other. I had a lunch scheduled that day over at the Pentagon, and I called my friend there and said, I'm not going to be coming. I got his assistant who said, they're evacuating the Pentagon. Of course you're not going to be coming, and you better think about evacuating the White House. And at that point, my wife called then and said she had seen the same news, and I'd better think about evacuating the White House. And you get this sense of sort of mulishness. No, I'm not going to go. I'm going to stay at my desk. I mean, one is hardly one of the more indispensable people in the United States government. There's no reason to stay at one's desk, but you have the sense of, I'm going to stay at my desk. And so I sat down very purposefully and grimly, determined to, write with renewed patriotism or whatever it is the Speaker is doing wartime. And at that moment, the Secret Service came along the corner, banging on the door, saying, evacuate, everyone is to evacuate. And we all moved out into the hall, and they began by saying, don't run, don't run. And then so they got some information, and they said, run, and everybody ran. I remember afterwards people would wear around their neck these badges with the Star-Spangled Banner on it with the motto, these colors, don't run. Well, that day they did. So we all ran. We ran out of the building. We ran up Lafayette Square, and they made us keep moving, and they shouted at us to take off our badges so we wouldn't be targets for snipers. And we got all the way up to about I Street, like 2 blocks from the White House, and we all then stopped, and no one had any idea what to do. And it turned out there was no plan. And the reason there was no plan was the last time anybody had thought that Washington might be in danger was sometime back in the middle 1980s. And what they were worried about was a nuclear strike on the White House. And their conclusion was, well, the president and the vice president will be safe in their plane flying off, and the staff will all, of course, be reduced to radioactive dust, so there's no need to make any special provision for them. But we all were alive and milling about and with no idea much of what to do or what was going on in the world. And cell phones didn't work, and we were all cut off.
What was the work that you did on September 11th and 12th and 13th?
The work we did on September 11th was the drafting of a series of suggested statements for the president. He spoke a couple of times from the various places that his jet touched down, and finally he returned to the White House and gave a speech that night. And it was like this great funnel of ideas flowing in. And so we wrote in this private office building, we wrote a series of drafts of things he might say. By and large, they were not accepted. But one thing did from those drafts did make it, and I think that was actually one of the key sentences of his decision-making. And that was the statement that the United States would regard as an enemy, not just the particular gangsters who committed this atrocious act, but also everybody implicated and the states that sponsored this act as well. And that was a truly decisive moment in the war, his decision to say that. The next day, September 12th, was one of the quietest days I can remember. That the presidency is contained, well, in many buildings, but the two most important are the West Wing and the Executive Office Building, which are across this tiny little street, West Executive Avenue, which was closed to the public in 1942 as a temporary wartime measure and has never reopened. And I think the way to think about it is the West Wing is sort of the brains of the presidency, and the Executive Office Building is the arms and legs. And all that day, the 12th, the brain was thinking, and there was almost nothing for the arms and legs to do. I just remember it as one of the quietest, stillest days I saw. The next day, the 13th, everything exploded into activity. The president gave his great speech in National Cathedral on the 14th, I think one of the most perfect speeches ever given by a president. Not just one of the best, because there are a lot of good speeches that are given by many presidents, but it's hard for a president to give a perfect speech because there's so many people who want to do things to speeches that end up making it less than perfect. That one, and again, that was mostly the work of Matthew Scully and John McConnell. That one I just thought was not just beautiful, but also flawless. And then the president flew up to New York for that wonderful moment when many Americans decided, yeah, we're going to be all right with this man in charge, when he took that bullhorn and made that completely unscripted remark to the workers on the site that he could hear them, and the whole world could hear them, and the world would hear from all the American people soon.
The Bush administration has been criticized by many journalists who cover Washington for its secrecy, and a lot of journalists think that that's not very healthy for the country to work within that level of secrecy. You said there was basically a press ban after September 11th. What was the ban?
In the immediate aftermath of September 11th, we had no idea what was going to happen and where the terrorists might strike next. There was a period of about 3 weeks, there was a ban on anybody below the level of senior staff having any kind of contacts with the press at all. It was a wartime measure of a kind that is much less stringent than has been put in place in other wars, and the ban came off in due time. I have to say I'm a little impatient with journalists' readiness to identify their own commercial interests with the good of the nation. I'm not so sure that it's right that the nation is well served when administrations leak like sieves. All administrations want to keep their secrets. The Bush administration here is no different from the Clinton administration, the Reagan administration, any of those that went before it. It wants to keep its secrets. Where it is different is that it succeeds in keeping its secrets. And I think the most interesting thing to understand why it is that they are successful. And the reason they're successful is not, as many journalists in Washington think, because there is some kind of heavy hand on the staffers, intimidating them into not talking. It's because President Bush is a man who's very good at creating a feeling of loyalty among those who work for him. And I think if you want to understand this administration and this man, the question of why is he so successful at winning loyalty when other presidents have been so much less successful, that's the most interesting thing about him.
Do you have an answer to that?
I do. I think he is good at winning loyalty because he's very good at giving loyalty. Presidents tend not to do that. Presidents tend to look at the people around them as very expendable, and they tend to wash their hands of anyone who gets into any kind of trouble. They can be very cold-hearted men often, and maybe they need to be. But George Bush has got quite a record of sticking by people and of remembering the people who remember him. Something even more. The most precious thing a president can do is to give the people around him a piece of himself. And I was struck almost the first time I met him, by a habit that he had of saying, in the presence of new staffers, people who he didn't have much of a history with, saying something that was indiscreet. I mean, not a state secret, but something that, if repeated, would be trouble for him. And everyone in the room would understand that, if repeated, this would be trouble for him. And he would say it to the staffers, and the staffers would all absorb it and take it away with them. And what he had done is he'd given them a piece of himself. And he had created a feeling of obligation in them that say, well, he's trusted me. Now I owe him my loyalty in return. And that's how the secrets are kept, because the people who work for him want him to succeed and care about him in a way that's maybe more personal than some recent presidencies.
I want to ask you about the most famous line that you wrote for one of the president's speeches, and that was the axis of evil. That was referring to Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. Although the way you originally wrote it before it was edited, it was the axis of hatred. And this was in the speech that President Bush gave just a few months after September 11th. It was his January 29th State of the Union address last year. Let's back up a little bit. What was your assignment?
The State of the Union address is like the moonshot of the presidency. It's the biggest thing that the White House works on all year and involves an enormous amount of labor by a lot of people that then has to be blended into a harmonious whole. So I had a series of assignments of things I was working on. And one of the things that I was asked to do was to come up with a coherent explanation of the relationship between Al-Qaeda and Iraq and the other problems in the Middle East that the United States faced. Is there some way of making it vivid to the people? Because Al-Qaeda is not controlled by Iraq directly. And although there was some evidence that the two of them had cooperated, we also knew that the two of them didn't like each other much. And that was true of many of America's enemies in the Middle East. Some kind of cooperation, mutual mistrust, but overriding hatred of the United States. And is there some way to bring all of this together? So I thought about this. I wrote a couple of pages on this to sort of describe what this relationship was. And I wanted to make a couple of points. I wanted to say, one, that the fact that these people disagree with each other and dislike each other is not going to prevent them from forming a common front of hostility to the United States, of working together against their most immediate enemy. And then I wanted to say that they're reckless. This is not like the Cold War, where the Soviet Union, wicked as the Soviets were, the Soviet Union was run by people who were very good calculators of risk. As we've seen, the terrorists that the United States is engaged with right now do not think in that kind of rational way. They're capable of anything. And the last point I wanted to drive home was to give some sense of the ideology that motivated these people. I mean, they use the language of Islam, but when you actually look at their ideas, they are much more like the fascism of the 1940s, that same kind of nihilism and to drive for total power and contempt for liberalism and democracy and the obsessive anti-Semitism that runs through it. So I wrote two or three paragraphs on the theme that this conflict bears some resemblances to that other one, and I then said that these enemies of the United States are linked together in an axis of hatred against the United States.
And how did axis of hatred become axis of evil?
Well, what happens is that this was written, when you write these things, you write your four paragraphs on I've got the Iran-Iraq Al-Qaeda brief, and I write my four paragraphs or five paragraphs or whatever it was, probably more than that, that I think should be in the speech. And then it goes into an editorial process, which is overseen by the chief writer, Mike Gerson. And it goes to the president, who's very, very involved. And one of the things that Gerson and the president had agreed from the beginning was they wanted to use the language of absolute good and evil, a more theological kind of language as a way of explaining this struggle. And so axes of hatred became axes of evil, which I think is rhetorically much more powerful. I think that was a good change. It may have been less exact, but more powerful. So it was very exciting. I mean, and they then took a lot of the rest of the language that I had drafted verbatim. It was a very exciting moment to watch it.
As you said, it was very rhetorically powerful, but the effect of that phrase has been very controversial. The axis of evil has been criticized for its bellicose rhetoric, which possibly helped incite North Korea to take its more aggressive stand on nuclear weapons. Let me just read you a couple of things. The Boston Herald on January 5th printed an article that said, "Few Western commentators question whether oppressive regimes in Iraq, North Korea, and Iran deserve to be labeled evil, but they are sharply divided over whether a Bush speechwriter's catchy phrase was a diplomatic gaffe or a purposeful warning shot across the bow of rogue nations." North Korea issued this statement in late October. "The Bush administration listed North Korea as part of the axis of evil and a target of U.S. preemptive nuclear strikes. This was a clear declaration of war against North Korea. In the long run, the Bush administration has adopted this as its policy to make a preemptive nuclear strike at North Korea." North Korea is saying that this whole axis of evil thing is part of the reason it's, thrown out the nuclear weapons inspectors and why it's revving up its nuclear reactor again.
Whenever a criminal is caught in mid-crime, he always says it's something that the policeman did that made him do it.
Mm-hmm.
At the time that the president made that statement, North Korea had been cheating on its nuclear agreements for close to 8 years. And they were indignant about being caught. But the idea that being caught is responsible for their transgressive behavior, that can't be right. I think the speech was, and the phrase was, exactly right. I think it did a couple of things that are so important. One was it made the American people understand this is a moral conflict. This is not a fight over some oil well. It's not a fight over strategic advantage. That what we are engaged in here is a struggle over what kind of century the 21st century is going to be. I mean, there was this extraordinary hopeful moment after the fall of the Berlin Wall when we really could think that that old American idea of a world united in peace and trade could be real. And terrorism and the states that sponsor terrorism is the biggest threat to that. It is our Nazi Germany, it's our Soviet Union, and it has to be dealt with not just as a strategic problem, but as a moral problem. That's the only way you can energize the American people to take action.
Doesn't that get to another issue that's been raised about the axis of evil, which is, if Iraq and North Korea are equated, why is it that we're preparing to go to war against Iraq, even though so far UN weapons inspectors have found nothing, whereas North Korea is making nuclear threats. It already has nuclear weapons. It's on the verge of getting more. The United States is concerned that it can sell the components of nuclear weapons to other countries and help terrorists and emerging nuclear powers. And yet the United States government is saying, no, we're not planning to attack North Korea. This is not yet a crisis. So if these countries are both part of that same axis of evil, what's the explanation for the double standard in how we're treating Iraq and North Korea?
We have as many standards as we have problems. I mean, it would be childish to say that every world problem must be treated in exactly the same way. As for the original axis, we didn't treat all of those countries in exactly the same way either. We made a much greater war effort against Germany than we did against Japan, even though it was Japan that had attacked us first. We took much more care and offered a much friendlier hand to Italy, even though Italy was also a member of the axis. We treated different problems differently. Iraq and North Korea and Iran, these are not our children who must all be given the same sets of rewards and punishments according to their merits. These are our enemies, and they are to be dealt with intelligently in light of our priorities and our vulnerabilities. Obviously, with North Korea, now that we have made the terrible error in the 1990s of allowing North Korea to become a nuclear state, we obviously have to proceed with more circumspection than we need in the case of Iraq, which is not yet a nuclear state. But it just strikes me as madness to say that since North Korea is now a nuclear state and therefore a very, very difficult and dangerous problem, that therefore we should wait until that therefore Iraq has somehow acquired the right to be allowed to become just a severe problem before we do anything. It seems to me that you want to handle problems in the order that makes sense from the point of view of the person faced with the problem. And the president is exactly right. Iraq is both in some ways the most urgent problem, also the one that is easiest to solve, also the one that in many ways where the United States has the strongest legal case, because Iraq is so flagrantly in violation of so many international commitments.
Okay, now your phrase "axis of hatred," which became edited to "axis of evil," has had immense ripple effects throughout the world. At the same time, it had a real real surprise ripple effect in your life, in that your wife emailed some friends saying that you had written that phrase, and she emailed that with pride, and somehow that email got forwarded to someone in the press, and this kind of violated one of the speechwriters' codes, I think particularly in the Bush administration, which is that speechwriters don't take credit for their phrases. So what were the repercussions in the White House when people discovered that this email had gotten loose to the press?
This is sort of a funny story, but it's also in some ways a story about the abuse of the press. I, at the end of January, had been at the White House for a year and decided that the time had come for me to go. I'd had a very satisfying year, been very interesting, but it had been a year. I wanted to write in my own name and voice, and the State of the Union, or at least my work on it, was behind me, and it was time to go. I handed in a letter of resignation about the 24th or 25th of January. State of the Union was delivered on about the 28th of January, and a few days after that, my wife sent a letter to, or an email to her brother and some friends, saying that I had written this segment, the portion of the speech dealing with Iran and Iraq. There's nothing so very remarkable about that. The New York Times Magazine had just published a long story about Karen Hughes's role in the president's speech. My friend Michael Gerson had given interviews to Diane Baltz of the Washington Post describing his role in the National Cathedral speech. The Bush administration was a discreet administration, but it wasn't a monastery. People did talk about the work they did all the time. there was nothing very remarkable about sending an email to friends saying that you had done something. One of the writers I knew there had a habit of whenever he had written a speech that he had was proud of, that he would circulate it to journalists all over Washington as, you know, here's something you might want to read. So this was something entirely normal. Now, what did happen was it did get intercepted, and Slate magazine got it. Email is a treacherous medium. And it became a two-day story, and it was mostly a two-day, this would be about the middle of February, a two-day very comic story, and I took a lot of razzing for it, which I, you know, took in good humor, and I mean, some of the things that were said were still pretty funny. Anyway, the end of February came, and my time to go came. As I was packing my bags, I'm watching television, and Robert Novak comes on television and says, I've been fired from the White House because of this email. It was a total invention. I have to say, it's one of these things also that you learn about Washington, which is this is a story that, you know, completely groundless, and yet television is powerful, and it will, you know, it lingers on in the ether.
Political journalist David Frum is my guest, former speechwriter for President Bush and now author of the book The Right Man, The Surprise Presidency of George W. Bush. You started off in the Bush White House writing economic speeches until September 11th, you know, when the emphasis of the speeches changed. When you started writing economic speeches, the thrust was more or less, there's a big budget surplus, so we're going to give some of this money back to its rightful owners, the American people, in the form of tax rebates. And we're going to cut taxes, too. Now we have a huge budget deficit, and we're facing a war that's going to cost billions and billions of dollars. And the president has just given his new economic plan, which calls for increasing tax cuts, about $600 billion worth of tax cuts over the next 10 years, including eliminating taxes on stock dividends. How can both extremes, the budget surplus and the budget deficit, call for the same reaction, which is tax cuts?
I think the president, in both cases, faces two problems that are a little different but still related. One is the problem of the short-term performance of the American economy, and the other is the problem of the coming retirement of the baby boom. And one of the lessons that John Maynard Keynes taught us about a society is societies cannot save for their future in cash. They don't have any place to put the cash. All they are doing is writing checks themselves. The way societies as a whole save for the future is by increasing their productive capacity. And the way we're going to pay for the retirement of the baby boomers is by making sure, if we succeed, is by making sure that the American economy of 10 and 15 and 20 years out is much more productive than the American economy of today, amazingly productive as that economy is. And President Bush, I think, has been pursuing from the beginning a program of comprehensive tax reform aimed at stimulating the long-term productivity of the American economy. He's trying, one, to get the economy out of recession by offering it some immediate advantages, and some of the tax cuts always do that. And the second and more controversial thing he's trying to do is to get the American economy in shape for the coming retirement of the baby boomers. And that's why he was so interested in things like, a year ago, lowering the rate of tax on incomes in order to encourage more investment, and now making sure that the corporate tax system is more rational. The reforms he's proposing to the treatment of dividends are endorsed, I think, by most economists, conservatives and liberals as sensible. Some of the more liberal ones may not like who gets the some of the benefit of that, but they agree that, at least in theory, that it would be good if the tax system did not favor debt over equity.
Well, let's face it, most more liberal people think that the tax cuts are going to benefit the rich and that the poor and the middle class aren't going to get much out of it at all. And therefore, how is that going to help their retirement?
Because over the 1990s, we built a tax code that is so redistributive, literally all of the taxes are paid by the top two-thirds of the population and none at all of the income taxes, and none at all are paid by the bottom third. And because we've also created a political taboo that says the payroll tax must never be touched because that's Social Security money and every politician knows that you mustn't touch it or else, you've created a situation in which tax talk is always going to be about the top two-thirds of the population. They pay the income taxes, which are the only taxes we're allowed to talk about. But it's certainly true. I mean, President Bush is a Republican and a conservative. He's not as radically free market and radically libertarian as some of the Republicans who preceded him, like Reagan and Gingrich, but he comes from a party that believes the answer is markets. And a market-oriented party is going to believe that tax cuts make sense. I mean, I could turn your question on your head and say the Democrats feel the same way. When times are good, they call for more spending, and when times are bad, they call for more spending. And they have an ideological commitment, too.
Now, you're actually Canadian by birth. Are you a U.S. citizen yet? Or are you a U.S. citizen? Let me take the yet out of that. Yeah.
I'm about to become a U.S. citizen. I'm not yet one. I've cleared the formalities. I just have to take the oath.
Now, you describe in the book that there are some restrictions that were initially put on you because officially someone who's not a U.S. citizen can't walk around unescorted in the White House, but eventually you were allowed to walk around unescorted. Did it feel odd at all to be working in the White House and still be a Canadian citizen?
It's odd. There's no rule against foreign nationals working for the president. The rule is a ban on foreign nationals walking unescorted inside the White House complex. And so for the first month or so that I worked there, I had to be escorted all the time, and I ended up not doing this. It was impossible. So what I would have to do is just, you know, make sure the coast was clear when I went to the bathroom. But I was once arrested. A guard saw me, saw that I had a badge that indicated that I didn't have a permanent pass, and he said, "You better come with me, and where are you going?" And I told him the number of my office, and he asked whose office it was, and I said it was mine, and he said, "That's just impossible. You can't have an office. You're a foreign national." He took me off to a boiler room, to a security station near a boiler room, and phoned around and found that, indeed I was. But there, it paid off in the end. And I paid off the very first time I traveled with the president. It was his first overnight trip as president. And we were staying in North Little Rock, Arkansas, and through some glitch, there weren't enough hotel rooms to go around. And so they ordered us all to double up, and I was given an assignment, a billet. I was told I was going to be staying with Colonel so-and-so. I knocked on the colonel's door and said, "I'm sorry to impose myself on you, but I've been billeted with you, and if you don't mind, may I put my stuff over there?" And I turned my head, and over there was the second bed in the room, and on the second bed was this briefcase, not a briefcase, a computer case, not a computer case. It was the football. It was the nuclear command code to the United States. And he looked at me as if I were completely crazy and said, "You can't stay in this room. What kind of security clearance do you have anyway?" And at this point, the light bulb went on. I said, "No security clearance at all, Colonel. In fact, I'm a foreign national." And he then went truly wild, picked up the phone, and got me my own room.
What a way to get it. Wow. All right. David Frum, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
David Frum's account of his year as a presidential speechwriter is called The Right Man, The Surprise Presidency of George W. Bush.